C1SP. Number 19B.
And if we do that, and only in the measure as we do that, we can claim we make ourselves the Son of God. And that was the accusation against Jesus, that he made himself the Son of God. And the rabbis said, according to our law, you see, makes again that gegenüberstellung, that contrast between God standpoint and the human standpoint, that we must take the standpoint of God and see man from the standpoint of God, and not to see man from the standpoint of mortal mentality. According to the rabbis, he had to die because he made himself the Son of God. So we can't ask to be the Son of God, and we wish to be the Son of God, and whenever we are in difficulties and have to work out the problem, we say to ourselves, but after all, I am the Son of God. But have we gone through the preceding steps where we first have seen, well, first of all, I am God's creation, and as God's creation, I am a derivative of God himself. And as a derivative of God himself in quality, have I ever broadened out my consciousness and my concept of manhood to that infinite horizon which is divinely given to me? Only then have I the right to say, I am the Son of God. Only then. Because anything little and small and narrow and incomplete and partial is not the Son of God. Having shown that, she shows that really all false government, all disharmony, that all that shuts us out from the kingdom of heaven and the reign of harmony, is that we take the false standpoint, namely the standpoint of mortal personality, and formed the concept of God and man from the point of view of mortal personality. That the Eastern empires and nations owe their false government to the misconception of deity, they are prevalent. And that the infinite is formed after the pattern of mortal personality, passion and impulse. See, she shows that the moment we start from the mortal and go out from the mortal in order to find the nature and quality and bigness of God and man, that we always will fall into a false government, into discord. That can never bring about something free and saving. But she shows then in the last paragraph that the progress of truth confirms its claims. And that in spite of any persecution which Jesus had to endure, that the true idea of man was progressing and pushing through. That any misconception coupled with denial, ingratitude and betrayal cannot hinder the progressive demonstration of truth. That we have to see. So here we have, you see, as a fourth standpoint, really that we have to see as a fourth tool, from where do I go out in considering what she calls in the side note, scientific man, in considering what constitutes man. I have always to go out from God, and not from mortal personality. Going out from God, it asks us to span our consciousness, to span the vision of what constitutes man as far and as wide and as infinite as God himself. That qualitatively, man is as big as God. God is quantity and quality. Man as a reflection is never a quantity. As a reflection, he only reflects quality, but infinite quality. Now, why don't we do that? Why are we not going to be big people? Not big in the world. That we can never be. Can never be big in the world. The only bigness that Jesus had in the world was that he was one day received with palm branches and the next day crucified. The world can give no truth. But inwardly we must be big. Inwardly we must feel the bigness. We are not from this world, but we must have another world. But let that world be big. Or it isn't another world, it's the old world. The bigness which asks us, why not to be big? Why not to reflect infinite life, truth and love? Why not? Where we constantly have to go back in the quiet moments and ask ourselves, how big am I? How big am I? Because the whisper of the serpent will always come and say, you are just nothing. You are just nothing. But that is not man. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is my place in the spiritual universe? How big is my place in the spiritual universe? And each one, we can't say to each one what he should see, because that's individual. The main point is that he sees that he must go as high and as far and as big as he can think of spiritually. He must do that. And in a measure as we do that, we always will rise higher, we always will feel a wider tent, a greater tent in which we live, a wider consciousness in which we live. And we begin to feel the mission which we have in this world. The moment we feel the mission which we have in this world, we come to the fifth subject. And the fifth subject shows us really the big mission which comes out of this world, of this consciousness. The bigger our unity, or the closer and the more consistent, congruent, the more congruent. You say congruent? Congruent? See, the more congruent qualitatively our vision is with the range of fetterless mind, with what she calls the capacity, the union with the infinite capacity of mind, the more congruent really that is, the more we begin to be the father of the universe, just as Jesus was. Then we look out from that principle's point of view and begin to read and to see and to behold the universe from that point of view of the infinite mind, of the immortal mind reading. This immortal mind reading is here shown as the fifth element, or the fifth tool in this scientific method of spiritualization. It shows Jesus as the one who could easily read thought, and that this mind reading was always to bless, that it was always here to bless and to direct thought of mankind aright, that he could not injure anyone with his mind reading. He was always constructive. See, that the moment we have that attitude of one of the qualitative oneness with the principle, then that has an effect. It begins to demonstrate itself first as the constructiveness of life. It begins to direct thought of mankind aright. It could injure no man. Though at his time, people said he did injure everyone. What she asks here and says, at this period nobody would say that he was injuring somebody, indicating that at his time, as the Bible tells us, people felt that he was a nuisance. that he was a revolutionist, that he set household at variance, that he brought the sword and not peace, that he did wound and not heal, that he brought a lot of trouble into the villages and into the cities, and that he set the whole nation into uproar, that he was a nuisance at that time. And only has to wait and to wait until general thought grows and grows, and then retrospectively one sees that the Christ sometimes seems to wound, but it always heals. That Christ can wound in order to heal. That the Christ does wound, but it only wounds mortal mind. It never wounds the divine mind. And that life must do that, that it is in the law of life, that it must stir up the lethargy of the human mind. And that stirring up of the lethargy of the human mind is experienced as disharmonious, as wounding, as not at all peaceful. But we must see that the essence of this divine mind reading is always good, is always good. And so she goes on and says that with this union, with the infinite capacities of the one mind, Jesus did always heal and save. The very interesting rendering there, which has always interested me much, because I think it's the only time in her textbook where she writes the effect of his mind, his Jesus, and mind with capital M. That Jesus' mind was mind. See, that Jesus' mind was really divine mind. See, when we speak about somebody else, we speak about his mind, but then we would write it with a small m. But here, the only time I think in the textbook she couples a personal pronoun, you say, his, with a capital mind m, his mind. See, because, and now we see it, you see, that will be true of us too. If we have gone through the order of the first part and then of the second part, and see, you remember yesterday how the end of the second part was showing that only that mind which is lined up with the divine mind is really divine mind minded, divine mind like, and that only is the real mind. So, lining up our mind with the divine mind, we really can say then that this divine mind, our divine mind, so the effect of his mind, she says, was always to heal and to save, was always the mind of Christ. It was always the mind of Christ. It was there to heal and to save. And so, and then she goes on and shows that to be spiritually minded, that's really to have the mind of Christ, the spiritually minded, is life. And as we go on, she goes over now from Jesus to we, shows that is not only an individual possibility, but that it is a universal possibility. We approach God or life in proportion to our spirituality and our fidelity to truth and love. And in that ratio we know all human need and are able to discern the thoughts of the sick and the sinning for the purpose of healing them. Then she says, error of any kind cannot hide from the law of God. See, that's very, very interesting to see. That she shows that in the measure as we are true immortal mind readers, becoming one with the infinite capacity of the one mind, that one mind has not only a Christ which heals and saves, but that it has also a Christianity which does not leave one error unturned, which does not allow one error to be hidden and go on smoldering and waiting until it can hit us. that it has a sense of, gives a sense of security, that we are secure in the divine mind, that not one error of any kind can hide from that divine mind. It gives a great sense of security of divine mind reading. And then lastly, she shows that this mind reading is impartial, that it is impersonal, that whoever reaches, whoever, it's quite impersonal, that whoever reaches this point of moral culture and goodness cannot injure others, but must do them good. See, it gives the sense of the principled nature of mind reading, that it shows that as we become true immortal mind reader, that must do good. It is not the moral demand that we should do good, but it's the irresistibility of a principle that it does right, and so it must do good. Now, let us just consider quickly this fifth subject as a whole, again, just to see the main tone in it. It gives a sense of the fatherhood of our spiritual culture. That if we culture our spirit, our scientific tools through admitting first God's perfection, then denying that there is another world, a material world, then third, rejecting within ourselves everything that wants to take away, that wants to threaten the integrity of this perfection, and fourth, taking in the bigness of you, of man, which is qualitatively as big as God, and spanning our horizon wide enough and broad enough and big enough and large enough and sublime enough to be congruent with God's nature, then we have inherited the whole inheritance. And from that point of view, we can only, out of that infinite capacity, can only come out something which is constructive. Then that mentality, then our spiritual mindedness, which is congruent with the infinite capacity of mind, can only bring out really the nature of life, namely constructive activity. And so she says, it enables us to direct the thoughts of mankind aright, that one cannot use this incisive power injuriously, that one cannot injure anyone by immortal mind reading, that the effect of it is always to heal and to save, that it enables one to discern the thought of the sick and the sinning for the purpose of healing them, always that fatherhood sense, that one cannot injure others and injure us. Now we get that sense that divine mind reading is really has its purpose a constructive effort and a constructive aim. We know that the fifth day in the days of creation has four tones. And Mr. Dawley showed that those four tones can be either viewed as life as mind, life as spirit, life as soul, life as principle, or also that it can be viewed as the word as the world, or the word as the Christ, the word as Christianity, and the word as science. And in this passage you see it very clearly. If you view it from life as mind, you see that this attitude is the fatherhood of mind reading, that it is relying on the omnipresence of mind and the infinite capacity of mind, which does always direct thought of mankind aright. You see. Therefore, then she goes on to life as spirit and shows this spiritual mindedness is always life. and that in this spiritual mindedness which is life, there is only the order of spirit, namely that it will always do good. It will always do good, always good, life of spirit. And she shows that in this spiritual mindedness lies the security of ourselves, life of soul, the security of soul, that not one error can hide, that we cannot be taken unaware by error, so that we get the security of soul. And then life as principle, which says, and this whole mind reading is impersonal. It's completely impersonal, and everyone can reach this point of moral culture. Or we can take it from the point of view of the world, as the world where she shows that approaching this life and approximating this life, approximating is always the word. We direct thought of mankind aright. We lead them in the divine order of the word, just as Jesus did. The word is the word. By going to life, the word, we lead everything which comes into our experience into that word of life. The word is the word. What does that word do? That word is always the Christ to a false order. It's always a Christ to some erroneous thinking, and therefore it says, and that going to the life, that going to the one mind and one mind reading has always a Christ. It heals and it saves. Where is the Christ? And then she says, but how far and how wide will this saving be? And she says, it is universal. Gives the universal sense of Christianity, and shows that it has a universal application, that by it we can know, you see the word, we can know all human need, Christianity, all human need, and that we can uncover every error of any kind. Christianity always brings error back to its nothingness. And lastly, she shows that this word is a science, that it is in Christian science that this mind reading is something very different than the wrong method, namely clairvoyance, which is the counterfeit science. I just hinted at this to show that this textbook is so exact. It's enormous. The more one just ponders that textbook, the more one stands in awe before two things. I always stand in awe before two things. First, that really God is a science and manifests and has revealed itself as a science, which is always consistent. Wherever one goes to the pages, there is always a big consistency, though there are infinite interrelationships. And the second thing which I always stand in awe is that a human being like Mrs. Eddy could put herself so away, so much out of the way, that human reason and common sense could be put so much out of the way that this message could be translated into a book on black and white without being marred by human beliefs and human opinions and anything of that sort. That really she could demonstrate that second part of spiritualism, where she could put all human beliefs and concepts right out of the way and let the spiritual light shine through and give us in that pages.